Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.
It's the 6th of August, 1936, Spain. Politician and FC Barcelona president Josep Sunyol is traveling for a meeting in Madrid. Journeys like this have become more precarious lately as General Franco's nationalist army leads a coup to take control of the country. Sunyol is a fierce Catalonian and a left-wing supporter, the kind of person that's become a target for Franco's violent supporters. He and a chauffeur move through the Sierra de Guadarrama, the Guadarrama Mountains. They round a corner only to see a checkpoint in front of them. This wasn't supposed to be here. They stop the car and it doesn't take long for the guards to realize who they are. The driver, Sunyol, a journalist and a lieutenant in the Republican Army, are dragged from the car. Angry words are exchanged between the groups of men as they're held at gunpoint. Minutes pass like hours. One of the guards disappears momentarily, comes back and mutters to several guards standing by. Then, without warning, Sunyol and his compatriots are shot. This is the Spanish Civil War, and it's only just beginning. Several days later, a telegram arrives for one Patrick O'Connell. In the message, he's told the man who hired him to be Barcelona manager has been murdered. The message is clear. We understand if you don't want to come back. It's very dangerous to be connected with the club. Civil war is enveloping the country. But O'Connell packs his bags. He's going back to his players. He's going back to Barcelona. The incredible story of Patrick O'Connell was, for a long time, lost, buried in the layers of time that passes. But in Seville and Barcelona, he'll never be forgotten. He made winning trophies a habit and made players feel 10 foot tall. This is the story of the first Irishman to captain Manchester United, to bring the first and only La Liga title to Real Betis, and the man who resurrected FC Barcelona from the ashes. This is the story of Patrick O'Connell. Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Caelan Kerwin. And as you heard, this week we're talking about the extraordinary life of Patrick O'Connell. And with us to talk about him is Fergus Dowd, who led a campaign to bring this incredible story to life, including a documentary called Don Patricio about the life of Patrick O'Connell. Don't forget to share the show on your own social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops, plus some bonus clips as well. So, let's get on with the show. Now, Fergus Dowd has led a campaign to get greater recognition for one of the greatest Irish managers of all time in Patrick O'Connell, and I'm delighted that Fergus joins us to talk about the campaign and, of course, the incredible life of Don Patricio himself. So before we talk about Don Patricio, maybe talk about your own journey about how you got involved in bringing this story back into the public eye.
Called Scott Bell. He is a friend of mine, and he played football in the northeast of England. And he sadly contracted motor neuron disease, and so we had to. Well, I suppose what we did was we raised monies, and we did a cycle originally around football grounds in the UK, and then we decided to do a talk and. There was a lot of, it was a weekend where there was a lot of Manchester United fans in Newcastle. It was in the northeast of England. And so I had loosely heard of the story of Patrick McConnell, but didn't know that stage that he was in a Mark Drive. And so what I did was I tracked down Sue and Mike O'Connell. So Mike was Patrick's grandson, and they live in Lee in Lancashire, because obviously he had played for Manchester United. So they we asked them, would they come up and tell the story at the evening? And so they came up, and Mike spoke about his grandfather, Patrick. And just at the end of the talk, he mentioned that he was in an unmarked grave. And Mike was in his late 70s, and Sue, his wife, she had multiple sclerosis, so they couldn't get down to London so they were looking for help. And they'd written to all these newspapers about the story for over 2 decades, and nobody came back to them. So myself, a friend of mine called Alan McLean, who's from Banbridge in the north of Ireland, and Simon Needham, who was from Leeds in England, decided we went up to them afterwards and said, look, we'd like to help and raise the funds for the memorial. And that's really how it began. And then in that August in 2014, we formed the Patrick O'Connell Memorial Fund, actually at the Belfast Celtic Museum, because Patrick's first professional club in Ireland was Belfast Celtic. So the idea really was to raise funds, to raise the money for the memorial. We just wrote off to former players, current players, anybody to sign jerseys, to send a jersey. And what we did was we auctioned. So, I mean, the first person who sent a signed jersey was the late Johan Cruyff, who obviously had played for Barcelona, managed Barcelona, and obviously played for Ajax and the great team, Dutch team in 1970. And so we raised much more than we had expected, which enabled us to do a bit more with the campaign. Like, as well as raising enough money for the memorial, we did a mural in Belfast, and then we worked with Dublin City Council on a plaque on Buston Fifth Avenue, and also a blue plaque in Belfast. So, and then we also went to Barcelona Football Club and presented them with the artwork that was commissioned by artists from Manchester, Tommy Denton, and then a sculptor, Joe Moran, did a bust for Real Betis. So we were able to go to different clubs and sort of put something in there to say, this man was here, you know, what are you doing at the football clubs? Because at the end of the day, he was the first Irish man, obviously, to win La Liga with Real Betis, their only title to date. And obviously, you know, his story at FC Barcelona was incredible, you know. And that sort of being, because the Spanish Civil War, the people there couldn't really, they sort of have, it's a bit like the Troubles in the North, they don't really talk about the Spanish Civil War, so that story had really forgotten. And so it was great to go to Barcelona. So that's how I really, I suppose, got involved. And then it culminated in, we actually got probably a week before we were to put the new memorial on in London. A chap called Michael Anderson, who was from Seville. Well, he's a Danish filmmaker, but he lived in Seville. He was a Real Betis fan. And he contacted us with the idea of doing a documentary. So he sort of followed us around. And then we launched the documentary in the Sugar Club in Dublin, and it was shown in the QFT in Belfast and the festival in Barcelona. So it sort of snowballed in a way. There's only the three of us, but it's sort of, we suddenly were finding ourselves, standing waiting to meet the president of FC Barcelona and stuff like that. So, when you start just looking to get a few jerseys signed, you don't think it's going to escalate. And then Paul Doyle from the Guardian newspaper he was the first person to write about the campaign. And like his story, actually, I remember he ran the next night and he got 250,000 hits in 24 hours, which was incredible. So, yeah, just really that sort of just a complete loop, really, you know.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic story and a dedication to a man whose history in football had been, I suppose, forgotten for a long time, certainly in this part of the world. If we talk about the man himself, though, where does his footballing journey begin?
I suppose, he was born, which is now the entrance. He was born at number 11 Jones Terrace, which is now the entrance to Hill 16. And he played for, there was Frankfurt, Stranville. But, the main club he played for was Liffey Wanderers, which are over Pierce Street area. Because he worked in Boland's Mills, so he played part-time football, youth football. And the interesting thing was, back then, obviously, Ireland was under British rule. This was like the early 1900s. So there was a cup for Dublin teams called the Empire Cup. And that was played by all the amateur teams, like youth amateur teams in Ireland, North and South. And Liffey Wanderers won that 3 years in a row, 1905, 1906, and 1907. So they won it three. So that sort of gives them a good grounding in football. You know, they were, you know, there was a very well-known club. His girlfriend at the time, later his wife, got pregnant. And it was sort of frowned upon in those times. So instead of signing and staying in Dublin, he decided to sign for Belfast Celtic. And so they went to Belfast, and they lived in a street called Albert Street, which is just off the Falls Road. He scored. Linfield, obviously, was Belfast Celtic's big rivals. And every year, up until Belfast Celtic finished, wound up, there was a Boxing Day derby. So they played, Linfield played Belfast Celtic every Boxing Day at Windsor Park.
Wow.
And this was 1908, so 07-08, and he scored a hat-trick in that match. But throughout the season, there was a lot of injuries, and there was a scout from Sheffield Wednesday. Sheffield Wednesday were then in the First Division. And so he was signed Wednesday, just at the end of season 1908. They were in the First Division. But a chap called Peter Warren went as well, and they signed for £25. And now, he did find it difficult. Obviously, Wednesday had there was a lot of competition. There was Bob McSkimming and Jimmy Spores. They were both English internationals. So he only actually made 21 appearances while he was at Sheffield Wednesday. But it was good enough. He played in 1912 Ireland in the British Home Championship, Daly Mount Park. England actually thrashed them 6-1. But that was his debut. He played, like, there was Mickey Hamill, who played up front that day. He had signed from Belfast Celtic to Manchester United. And that was then, he had signed for £175, which was a record signing then. O'Connell would actually become the highest transfer when he moved to Manchester United. But Hamill had that record for 2 years. He played up front. But he made some, like, fleeting appearances at Hillsborough as a centre-half. But again, he was up against two English internationals, you know, to get a place. So he moved just to East Yorkshire, to Hull City, and they were then a second division team. But it's here is he, you know, became a regular, and he then Ireland then played in the 1914 British Home Championship, just before football was actually wound up, before World War One. So they the first match was actually against Wales at Wrexham. They won 2-1. And then they played England at Ayresome Park. They call it the Valentine's Massacre because it was played on the 14th of February 1914. And Ireland won 3-0. It's the first time, like, everybody talks about Ray Houghton and, you know, the goal in Stuttgart. Yeah. But this was actually the first time that Ireland ever beat England on English soil. So they had to play Scotland. All the internationals, well, very few internationals played in Dublin then. The IFA were in charge of Irish football, and all internationals were played at Windsor Park. There was 31,000 turned up. It was March 1914. I think it was a day or two before Patrick's Day. And, like, they describe it in the books that, like, there was, you know, in the crowd, there was gunfire going off, and there was also, you know, it was sort of a different terrorist culture nowadays. But O'Connell actually broke his arm just before the halftime whistle. There was no substitutions in those days. Mm. And so we had to play on. And Scotland actually scored first around the 70th minute. It was actually a chap called Joe Donaghy. Mm. He was actually one of the first Catholics to sign for, he was Glasgow Rangers, but he was actually, people talk about Mo Johnson, but Donaghy. This was before Glasgow Rangers only brought the rule in the 20s after, or about only signing Protestants. So he was one of the first Catholics to play for Rangers. He scored in the 70th minute, but Sam Young, who played for Linfield, he scored in the 89th minute. So Ireland then won the British Home Championship. Now, there was no trophy back then. The trophy actually came into being in the 30s. Mm. King George the VI, I think, was he brought in the British Home Championship. So each player got a signed pocket watch, which was engraved British Home Championship. And when we were doing the campaign, Sam Young's grandson contacted us and he actually had the pocket watch in Belfast, you know, the 1914 that they were presenting with. So, yeah, so they didn't, that was what they received. And obviously it was a huge thing because Ireland's, in 1912, Ireland had finished bottom. They lost all their matches, right, and suddenly they were champions. So O'Connell excelled in this tournament, and so Manchester United, Ken Colley, and they signed him for £1,000, which was an astronomical fee back then.
Huge fee.
It was so much money that United paid Hull City in installments. So he, unfortunately, his career was sort of affected by World War One, because he only had one season, and United were had lost a lot of their, you know, team that had won. Charlie Roberts had moved on, and had the team that won their first ever title in 1908 had left the club, so they were sort of struggling a bit, you know, towards the end, middle end of the table, a bit like they are today, to be honest with you. And so he, but O'Connell, in that season, he was given the captaincy, so he became the first Irishman to ever captain Manchester United in season 1914-15,
it seems,
just before the regular year. And also, interestingly, the players from Manchester United had also formed the Players Union, the PFA. That's why the headquarters are in Manchester. When they formed the union, they were known as the Outcasts. I mean, the British media went mad, and they were banned from playing football. The Football Association had banned them. So all that was going on. And when we were doing the campaign to raise funds, we got in contact with PFA. And interestingly, we spoke to Martin Buchan, who's a former Manchester United captain.
That's right, yeah.
And Stephen International. And he found a ledger from 1914-15 season with Patrick O'Connell paying his membership fees.
Fantastic.
So, which was
a good union man.
Yeah. So he was, it was very much the ethos of the club at the time.
Talk to us about who he was as a player. He seemed to have great leadership qualities. So how did he play? What was his skill set?
Yeah, I suppose very much it was in the mould of Tony Adams, I suppose. A tough centre-half, leader, captain, you know, voice for us in the dressing room, you know, opinionated. You know, somebody that would definitely go into management, you know, that way. But also very defensive-minded. Like, when he went into management eventually, his teams were very much based on defence and then transition. You know, quick attacking style of play. You know, if you look at the Real Betis team, won La Liga, they only conceded about 16 goals. So very much, very ahead of his time. He banned his players from smoking when he became a manager. So he was, even though he was a chain smoker himself, you know, he was very aware of, like, tactics were only really coming into the game then. You know, it was still very much a 4-4-2 system, but then changed 4-3-3 and different variations when he went to Spain. But as a player, no nonsense centre half, you know. But he could play, you know, he was a player that liked to play on the ground as well. He didn't just hoof it, he would find the player. You know, there's a lot of reports about him being a very stylish centre half as well. Yeah, you know, but very great leadership qualities. I mean, he was a foreman at age 15 in Bowland's Mills, which is unheard of, you know. So yeah, always had that sort of leadership qualities, and not afraid to give his opinion, you know, in a dressing room or, you know, to fellow pros. So yeah, so I say he, unfortunately, World War One sort of interrupted his career at Manchester United. So he, you know, during the war, he guessed it down in Clapton Orient, who are now Leighton Orient in the East End of London. Interestingly, he was working in an ammunition factory during World War One, and incredibly, he had become very good friends with Oscar Traynor. You know, Oscar Traynor was a goalkeeper at Belfast Celtic.
Yeah, that's right.
And O'Connell worked in Ford during the summer when he was at Manchester United in Manchester, so he had access to a car. So he actually was gun running, believe it or not, as well during the Easter Rising. He was sending home ammunition over to Dublin, which we found out for the documentary. Which is, you know, it's, you can imagine Roy Keane or Brian Robson, you know, gun running. As he was still captain, he was still the football club, even though football had been suspended. So he was very political minded even before he went to Spain. You know, very left leaning, left wing. But I'd say he, he went to Dumbarton for a season, played in Scotland, and then went to Ashington, and that's, he became player manager then about 1921-22 season. And it was actually a chap called Fred Pentland, who was then manager of Racing Santander. Mm. They run a tour to the northeast of England. They were playing Hartlepool. Pentland was moving on to Athletic Bilbao, and he actually recommended O'Connell for the job. But he sailed from Blois on a coal ship.
And how did that come about? Did he recommend O'Connell on what he saw in that match, or were they friends? How did he get the Bettis job?
See, O'Connell sort of, even though Ashington were in the, they were sort of Tour Division North, he sort of rejuvenated them, and he got a lot of good press in the northeast of England. Pentland was from the northeast. He had played for Middlesbrough, I think. And he'd come home a few seasons before that, and he'd been reading about O'Connell and knew he played against him. They met up when he was, when he came back to Hartlepool to play the friendly that season, and he was saying to O'Connell, look, I'm heading off, but I think this will be a good fit for you. You know, would you be interested in going to Santander? So he knows Spanish. He met his wife. His wife was still, and family were still in Manchester. They remained in Manchester with him. They did go to Scotland with him. So he decided to go up to Spain. Now, he thought he'd only go for a year or two. Mm. He used to send drinkers home to the family and decided to go. So he actually sailed on a coal ship from Blyth Port in the northeast of England to Santander, arrived with a suitcase. This was before La Liga. So they played in the Cantabria League, which is the regional league before La Liga was formed. He won Cantabria League 5 years in a row. Then La Liga came into being in 28. So they had to, Santander weren't given a place. They went into the playoffs. Actually, Real Betis were in the playoffs as well to play. And they won the playoffs. And they, so he was at the top table when La Liga was founded. He was, they were one of the 10 clubs racing Santander. And then he moved to Oviedo, which is just down in the north of Spain as well. They were in the second division at the time. And he, I mean, his most famous thing there was a kid called Isidro Langara, who the street outside Oviedo Stadium was named after Langara. He was only 17 years of age, but he came in off the street, and he was he asked O'Connell, could he train with the team? And O'Connell said yes. And he was real rough diamond, but he trained for half an hour, and O'Connell signed him on the spot. And the directors thought he was insane, you know, the club. And Langara went on to get the Pichichi Award for like a golden boot in Spanish La Liga for top scorer. And he was top scorer in the early 30s, 3 seasons in a row in La Liga. A bit like Cristiano Ronaldo of his time. But he was their greatest footballer, Oviedo's greatest footballer. And then he went on to play for Spain. And he was a Basque. So he was just... But O'Connell, he had that law, you know. He's very much, could say, young players. You know, a lot of the team at Betis was around young players as well. But he knew immediately when he saw this kid, yeah, I've got to sign him. And he went on to be one of the, you know, the greatest player that the club has ever had. I'm one of Spain's greatest strikers of all time.
He strikes me as a... Yeah, just connected with that player there. It seems like he really knows his teams. He sees a player, likes what he sees. He thinks, wow, I got to get this kid in here. So it seems like he really knows the kind of players he wants in his teams and what fits and what he wants to do with them.
Definitely. I mean, he was very much his own man. And, he knew he could, I suppose all great managers do. I remember hearing Brendan Rodgers talking about, you know, somebody had asked him how you can tell kid of 12 years of age is going to be, and he was saying you can know by, even at that age, touch, you know, technical ability or football brain. And O'Connell was the same. He was able to, he very much was team orientated, and you know, he could see, well, this, if I get this kid now, like, I don't want Atletico Bilbao taking him or Racing Santander, so I'm going to sign him now, 17, you know. And you know, he had no experience. You know, this kid had never played youth football or anything, you know, in, you know, at a club or never. So he just knew that, look, he's going to fit in here. He's going to, you know, and Langara had that sort of raw determination as well, you know. And he sort of fitted in with what, he's very pacey. So he fitted in the style of play that O'Connell was looking for, you know, which was a defensive shape, but then to break quickly. That was always his, you know, quick passing and break quickly. Total transitional play. But he was always like, when he went to Barcelona, he, you know, Ventrola was another player that he had signed. Right. He knew immediately when he got him that, you know, he'll fit into what I want. But it was always, you know, tough team defenders, pacey forwards, you know, with an eye for goal. But I say, unfortunately, with Oviedo, he was there two seasons and then he went to Betis, to Seville. And they were again in the second division, but they won the second division with O'Connell. And then they went to, 1934-35, they won La Liga. You know, they had to travel, even in the last match, they travelled Santander, they played Santander. It was really tight. They picked Real Madrid by a point. Mm. And they bet Santander 5-0 in the last match. But back then, you had to travel to the team who had the trophy. So Bilbao had won the league before, so they had to go up to the Basque Country, collect the trophy by bus, and then travel back. But it was a bit like Italian 90. When they came back to Seville, there was 500,000 people waiting for it, on the streets with the trophy. So, yeah, it was the first time they'd ever won La Liga. And there's an actual monument just across the stadium in Seville dedicated to that team. And obviously there's a bus now in the museum of Patrick. But, they've never won it since. I mean, interestingly, with Real Betis, they wear green and white because their founder, Miguel Massenio, they originally wore blue shorts, but he went to a Marist school outside Glasgow. And he went to see Glasgow Celtic play, and he took home one of their jerseys, believe it or not. And that's why they wear green and white.
Wow.
So there's a link. And obviously Glasgow Celtic were founded by Brother Walford, from Islam. So there's all Irish connection as well. So, that was huge because Betis had never won La Liga. So it's sort of like Patrick O'Connell then became Don Patricio in Spain. So that's when FC Barcelona came knocking.
Where is Barcelona around this time? Are they one of the dominant teams that we know now? Where were they before he arrived?
Yeah, I mean, they were going through a period where, I mean, Barcelona seemed to go through these periods, like it's before even Cruyff arrived, they were going through, you know, Venables as well, before Venables arrived, they had a few seasons where he didn't win La Liga, so it was a bit like that. So he had rebuilt a young team, and they didn't play at Camp Nou because Camp Nou was only came into being in the 50s. Mm. They played in a stadium which is now a park down the road from Camp Nou called Le Court. But, I mean, they were still a huge club. They were, you know, Real Madrid and FC Barcelona, Athletic Bilbao. You know, they were the three dominant clubs in Spain at the time. So, I mean, huge following. And, obviously, they were the you know, the pride of Catalan as well, you know. Of that region. But as I say, O'Connell had a good fourth season. They reached the Copa del Rey final. It was actually the first, what they call the first El Clasico, it was the first El Clasico final between Barcelona and Real Madrid. And a lot of the players that played that day ended up fighting, you know, against each other in the Civil War because that was going to break. It was the last match played before the Spanish Civil War broke out.
Wow.
So it was season 35-36, yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of history and a lot of politics involved.
Yeah, so it was, and as I say, Madrid went on to win it 2-1. There was a great save by the Madrid goalkeeper in the last few minutes, which stopped Ventrola from scoring an equaliser. So he had, like, they were very confident. Like, O'Connell had spent the season sort of rebuilding the team, and they were looking really good for the following season. But obviously, the Spanish Civil War broke out. He was actually holidaying in Ireland when it broke out. Got a telegram to say, look, if you don't want to come back, we understand. But he went back, took a drop in wages, and they played for a...
Is this about the time the president of the club gets shot? He gets killed?
Yeah. So Josep Sunyol had gone down to Madrid for a meeting. He was a bit of a firebrand Catalan politician, but he was also president of the football club, and he'd gone to a meeting down in Madrid, and there was just coming back out of Madrid through these mountains. Actually, he was assassinated. His body has never been recovered, so he was killed. Sort of, the football club was in turmoil, you know. They couldn't play any matches well. So what they decided then was, as the war progressed, they played for a championship called the Mediterranean League, which was played by a lot of the clubs affiliated to the Republican side. So Franco was the nationalist side, and then you had Barcelona won that championship. The club say it as a Liga title. Levante won the cup competition. And so just to give you an idea, they had to travel at night by train for fear of death. They would have been assassinated, the team, if they were caught, you know, traveling around playing football, you know, because Barcelona were seen as, you know, a Republican-affiliated club. So they win that, but then it just gets more difficult and difficult to play matches because, as the, you know, the nationalists are taking over more and more of the country. So in 1937, they get a lifeline. A Mexican Catalan businessman contacted the club, and through the president at the time in Mexico, Larizenas, he was very left-leaning, very pro-Republican. So he invited the team through contacts with the club. He invited Barcelona to come and play exhibition matches. Mm. So they actually, they left in May 1937, took a train to Paris. Ireland were actually playing France that week in Paris in 37. And a number of the players, I think Val Harris, who had been in that 1914 team, was then one of the coaches of the Irish team. So he actually met up with O'Connell in Paris before, you know. While they're in Paris, they opened one of the committee members from the club opened the secret bank account. So they went from Paris down to Saint-Nazaire, which is on the coast, sailed on a refugee ship with a lot of orphans who, like, parents had basically put their kids on the boat just to get them out of Spain. And so they sailed to Veracruz in Mexico. And if you ever go to Veracruz, there's actually a statue to all the people who arrived from Spain during the Civil War. So when they arrived, I mean, there was thousands on the quayside. They sailed through Cuba. They went to Havana, Cuba. They stopped off in Havana and then went on to Mexico. But there was thousands waiting for them. There was great footage of the boat coming in. You know, while they were on the boat, they trained in they trained on the boat, like O'Connell had them training as well. So they played 10 matches in Mexico. They went then to New York, played a 4 or 6 matches. I think in total they raised about $12,000, $12,600. That money was wired to the bank account in Paris, and those money saved the club from extinction.
Wow.
So interestingly, most of the players absconded. A lot of the players stayed in Mexico because Franco had said if they come back into the country, they'd be assassinated, because a lot of the Spanish press covered this. The tour was known as the Tour of Salvation at the football club. There's a little bit about it in the museum in Camp Nou. It basically saved the club, and only 4 players returned with O'Connell. And again, he rebuilt the team, stayed there till 40, and eventually Franco installed his own people into the football club. So FC Barcelona became the Spanish for, if you look at the crest from 1940 to until Franco died in the late 70s, it was Club Football de Barcelona, which is now it's FCB. But while it was under Franco's rule, it was CFB.
How do we know how he himself is dealing with this? I mean, the backdrop is a civil war. Your president's been assassinated. You have serious financial problems. How is he dealing with this kind of pressure?
Yeah, now, we found the house that he lived in it was, like, this gives you sort of an idea. He lived only 600 metres from Le Court. So he just immersed himself. Everywhere he went, he lived close to the football ground. So he just immersed himself in the football club, the history of the place, the history of Spain. I don't know. Like, he just seems to be a guy that, you know, he obviously was dedicated to everything because, you know, there's not many people that would sort of remain in a place where there's a chance you're going to be killed.
Yeah.
You know, so obviously in the middle of a civil war. So he was just huge. Obviously a very determined person, but also very, I think he was very political minded as well, in that he felt, well, look, I'm, you know, you've signed me. you know, while we can still play some sort of football and while we can keep this club alive, I'm going to stay here. You know, that's what it was sort of, you know, he had, you know, back in 1936 when he got the telegram, he could have just stayed in Ireland or went back to England or tried to get a job there or something. But, you know, the way he was, he said, no, I'm coming back. And, you know, it is incredible that he, you know, with all those pressures, he stayed there. And obviously he was successful as well because the club has fought, you know, that title is a La Liga title, the Mediterranean League. So, you know, he's obviously huge determination. I mean, the other interesting thing is that he, you know, when he went back to London, Franco had said that anybody that was on that tour, if they left, they wouldn't be allowed back in to Spain. He was back in Spain after 8 months, you know, and he was manager Real Betis. You know, they were back in the second division. And he, you know, he did the same trick again, won the second division, brought him into La Liga. Went on to manage Sevilla. They were, he built a team there. It was like a bit like going from Celtic to Rangers or, you know, Man United to Man City, but like Alex Ferguson taking over at Man City because they were huge rivals. So it's, you know, I remember we spoke to, Michael spoke to Sid Lowe for the documentary, the Guardian journalist, and he was sort of saying, like, how does he do this? Like, nobody knows how, you know, he's part of this team that go on this tour. They save the club. Everybody else is banned. Like, a lot of the players that were on that remained in France, never went back to Spain or went back to Barcelona. But O'Connell, you know, he goes back in, and it's a bit like, how did you do this? Like, how, you know, how we got back in? It's just incredible. So, obviously, he built another team at Seville, and it was really funny because we met a gentleman in one of the cafes. There's a sort of a cafe for that the Real Betis team used back then in the 40s. And O'Connell used to go there. And even as Sevilla manager, he was the only person from Sevilla who was allowed into the cafe. He used to have his coffee there and read his paper every morning, even though he was the manager of Sevilla, you know. So he was just adored in the city. Like, so he rebuilt the Sevilla team. They came second in La Liga in 1945-46, and then in 46-47 they won La Liga, but it was a team that he built. He'd moved back to Racing Santander. I suppose then he went back after Sevilla to Santander. He won the Tour Division title with Santander. So he's the only Irishman to ever win La Liga, but he's the only man in Spain to ever win Tour Division, Second Division and La Liga titles. Nobody else has ever done.
I know we touched on it earlier in the conversation, but what kind of manager was he? Because it seems like everywhere he goes, he's successful. He somehow manages to sprinkle some magic. He gets the most out of his players. How is he developing teams that just win things?
Fantastic man management skills. You know, he's able to, if when he's taught, like, I mean, we spoke to one of the old players from Betis who was still alive, and he said to us, like, he made you feel like you were 10 foot tall. You know, like, even if you were a young lad, you know, he made you feel, like, very special, but very, you know, tactically aware. He was ahead of his time with diets. And, you know, as I said earlier, he didn't allow his players smoke. Very defensive-minded, but his style of play, you know, the way he played in Spain suited the Spanish, the warm climate during the summer or, you know, even in autumn. They played very much on the break, transition, tight defence, sort of very much like like George Graham type style, if you like. You know, very, you know, the same back four, you know, and then really quick transition. He just had a great eye for players as well. You know, he was able to sign young players that were coming through. Even at Barcelona, he had started to sign different parts of the country, and he was building that team. But he would always have a couple older players in the team as well, you know, but sprinkled with these young lads. So his man management skills, people talk about it. And obviously, yeah, I mean, he just had that. He knew how to win things, winning formula. You know, he knew everywhere he went, he was able to, you know, put a team together and put them into a specific state, would win league title and bringing players through an enduring season as well. You know, because back then, you had to travel by bus. There was no airplanes, or, you know, so they were traveling around the country. I think the Betis team did thousands of miles when they won La Liga, you know, and even had to go up and collect the trophy. So, as I said, I think his man management skills is what he's known for. He would have, you know, he made players feel like they were well above, they were punching well above their weight, you know.
I think it's interesting hearing you talk about him in that kind of way. He seems like a real philosopher of the game. I mean, we talk about the Guardiolas, the Klopps, the Fergusons, and yet it seems like he was doing things that they've done 100 years before any of those types of managers.
Yeah, no, I think with Alex Ferguson, look, even at Alex Ferguson, he was similar background, came from Govan, shipbuilding, you know, working class, but obsessive. O'Connell was obsessive, like Ferguson talks about being forced into Cliff. O'Connell was similar, lived close to the stadium, would be the first person, you know, at the ground in the morning time. You know, so yeah, I think these guys are just totally obsessed with football. And he was one of these people who was, you know, when he met his son came over to meet him in to Sale. And the first question he asked him was, like, not how are you doing or how's life. First question he asked him was, how are Man United doing back in England? You know, so totally obsessed with football, you know. So these guys are, they live and breathe the game, you know. And everything else is second. So he was a bit like that. He was just totally obsessed with the game. But I think the sad thing about that period is that, unlike today where the league is covered by British journalists and Irish journalists, and, you know, people in Ireland now know the clubs. Back then, you know, Spanish football wasn't as popular in Ireland or the UK as it is now. And that sort of meant that Patrick's achievements weren't really covered by the British press or the Irish press. So nobody really knew there was an Irish man in Spain doing all these things. And as well as that, there was a lot of English football, like the Football Association of England sort of frowned upon European teams because they saw themselves as, you know, the kingpins of football. You know, we founded the game. And so, you know, they were very reluctant even to allow, even in the 50s, as O'Connell sort of finished up in Spain, they were very reluctant to allow English teams to go into Europe, to compete in Europe. You know, I know Matt Busby had a lot of, the Football Association didn't want Manchester United in Europe. I know Wolverhampton Wanderers were one of the first teams to play in Europe in England under Stan Cullis. And so, you know, you had that. So when O'Connell does finish up and he goes back to London, you know, goes back to England, nobody really knows. You know, he can't get a job, you know, and, you know, his achievements aren't, you know, it's not like today if there was, you know, say, Robbie Keane or somebody who's, you know, a former Irish player is in management and they went now to Spain and they won that league, it'd be massive, you know, it'd be
everywhere.
Robbie Keane went back into Ireland, somebody, you know, went back, any Irishman, but, you know, when he went back to London in 54, nobody knew he had done this and couldn't find a job. He was living in an attic in not too far from Pancras Hospital, King's Cross Railway Station, and he was like drawing the dole, you know, he couldn't get a job, so you know, he ended up penniless, you know, and he died from pneumonia in 1959. He was found dead in the attic, and he was brought to St. Pancras Hospital, buried in an unmarked grave, and his mother was the only person that attended the funeral. And I mean, interestingly, when he was penniless or going through this upheaval in his life, FC Barcelona were opening Camp Nou. They were, you know, the man who had saved the club nearly 20 years before had been forgotten about, you know. He wasn't even invited to it, you know. So it shows how fickle football is and how ultimately you stop, how you're forgotten, you know. You know, sadly then, obviously, he was buried in an unmarked grave and really forgotten about, you know, until obviously we... but it's great now because, you know, a lot of people are aware of the story. And, you know, it's great that people know. And it's great for Sue and Mike as well, you know, that finally, you know, their relation is talked about in the same breath probably as, you know, Martin O'Neill and Neil Lennon, who also, you know, from Ireland, who won championships. And, you know, so it's a good thing. And the clubs, you know, fans and football clubs know about his story.
Yeah, you mentioned his son earlier. Am I right in saying that after he moves to Spain, that relationship with his family just peters away, it kind of stops?
Yeah, I mean, himself and his wife were very Catholic. And I suppose if it was now, they probably, when he went to Spain, they probably would have got divorced. But he just kept the relationship you know, he sat beside his home. They were aware of what he was achieving. I think they got in contact with him during the Civil War. And, yeah, I mean, he'd spent so long in Spain that I suppose if you think about it, it's not like the Spain of today where people get a cheap plane here flight. You know, it's like going to Australia in the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, going to Spain in the 20s, 30s. You know, as I say, none of the football was covered in the UK. You had to sail. You know, it took 2 or 3 days to get there.
Mm.
It was a totally different era. And, yeah, I mean, I don't think he expected to, you know, to flourish in Spain. Well, definitely not to stay there for 30 years. Mm. And so, yeah, his relationship just totally fizzled out. Even though at the start he did send home letters, you know, sporadically then. But, yeah, his son, you know, came to see him in 1954. Early 1950s. So he did have that. You know, his family knew he was still in Spain. But just, you know, I think it's like a lot of Irish men who went abroad. You know, sometimes it just didn't work out, you know. And that was, you know, occasion. But I think they just stayed married because, you know, in Ireland especially, the Catholic Church ruled with an iron fist, you know. So sort of divorce was, you know, it was just an unknown word, especially for Irish people then. But, yeah, I mean, it was just one of those things. I think a lot of Irish men, especially in the 50s and 60s, who went to work in London or went to the States or Australia, you know, a lot of their marriages fizzled out as well. You know, it's just one of those things. You know, when you're away as well, it's difficult. You know, I mean, people would send money home, but very, very difficult when you're in, like, obviously, you know, a tough situation. But he felt that, you know, this was an opportunity for him to improve his, you know, his skill set and do things that, you know, these were the biggest clubs in Spain he was managing, and he wouldn't get that opportunity in England, you know. Unfortunately, it's a bit, his story is very much a rags to riches story and back to rags.
Yeah.
You know? But I think we talked to Niall Quinn for the documentary, and he was saying that, you know, he was obviously chairman of Sunderland Football Club. And he was saying that, you know, 3 out of 5 footballers nowadays, even today, get divorced. You know, it's a lot of suffer. O'Connell, you know, he became an alcoholic, you know, in later life because he couldn't find work and he couldn't live without football. And it's a lot the same for players. You know, when players are wired to be involved in the game from the age of, you know, when they sign as a teenager up until mid-30s, all they do is football and everything is done for them. And then they're gone and their whole lives can totally unravel.
Well, I mean,
you know,
it's
people like Paul Gascoigne, you know, it just does George Best. You know, it just happens, you know, they can't live without it. And then, unfortunately, they turn to addiction. And, you know, a lot of times marriages unravel. So, yeah, he was just explaining it's still happening. You know, especially, there's a lot of people don't realise, they sort of see the glamorous side of football, but for journeyman people, like when O'Connell started, there is a lot of travel involved and upheaval, you know, kids going to different schools and all that. So it was still happening in that now. So, you know, he probably felt that, well, if I go here, when they met Newcastle before he went, fan probably felt, well, we'll stay here and then you go off and you'll probably be back in a year or two. Yeah. You know? But that wasn't the case. So, yeah, so it's just, I suppose, it's still happening in football, you know.
So how do we assess Patrick O'Connell then? How do we put these massive footballing parts together in his career?
He's like a man of force, if you like, in that he, you know, first Irishman to captain Manchester United, first Irishman to win La Liga, you know. So he did things that a history maker, I suppose. You know, he sort of led the path then for people like Jackie Carey and Roy Keane. And Manchester United, you know, that would go on to captain the club, Noel Cantwell. An amazing character, you know.
Yeah.
You know, a brilliant football, you know, football brain, great, good player, and just a fantastic manager. You know, probably one of the greatest Irish football managers of all time. But just forgotten about, sadly, but, you know, resurrected, I suppose.
If people want to find out more about your journey with this or about Don Patricio himself, is there books or documentaries, etc.?
Sue O'Connell wrote a book. It was published by Amberley UK back in 2016. It's called The Man Who Saved Barcelona, the Patrick O'Connell story. And then there's Don Patricio documentary. You'll probably find it on YouTube, Michael Anderson's documentary, which came out in 2017. And there's also a documentary by T.G. Carr, which was done by Tony Devlin from Belfast. He was the narrator. And Grainne McIlwain, who is on GAA Plus these days, they produced the story, Patrick. And we have also, there's a Facebook page, Patrick O'Connell, and on Twitter, we're at Patricio Fund. So yeah, the mural is still standing in West Belfast on the White Walk Road. And there's Patrick's plaque is still there. If you're ever going to Crow Park, just across the road on Fitzroy Avenue, number 87. And in Albert Street, there's the blue plaque if in West Belfast. And obviously at Rail Bettis as well, a story. So yeah, it's definitely out there. And there's numerous articles written now since we began the campaign.
Yeah, and I suppose the ultimate testament to him is that Real Betis and FC Barcelona are still around, still playing football, and Barcelona are still winning trophies.
And I mean, he's still the only man to ever win La Liga with Real Betis. They haven't won it since. And obviously, you know, Barcelona have become this huge, you know, this monstrosity of a club, you know. You know, and with the great players that have gone on to play for the club, you know, so.
Fergus, thank you very much for joining us today and talking about the amazing story of Patrick O'Connell and, of course, your own story and bringing him into much-needed public eye.
Sure, good feeling. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks again to Fergus for that incredible story of Don Patricio Patrick O'Connell. Don't forget to share the show on your own social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops, plus some bonus clips as well. And remember to support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League side. It's our heritage, it's our game.